Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. On today's episode, I'm interviewed by my childhood best friend, Maya Scalia, to introduce me to any new listeners, explain why I sought treatment at McLean Hospital, and the new direction of this podcast.
So should we get to it?
Yeah, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, okay. So I'm Maya Scalia. I am a longtime best friend of Eileen. We've known each other since we were 11. I think that's right. We met at sleepaway camp. And we've lived in New York for the past 7 years. And I'm an actress and a writer. And I'm super excited to be here. And I'm excited to chat with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on. And grateful to kind of be able to do this first episode with someone I'm so comfortable with.
Well, I feel also very honored that you asked me to interview you.
So I think maybe it's important to talk about why I decided to even do this first episode this way.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I had a former podcast called Pillow Talk that did great, was great. But I had some events in my life, which we're going to get to, that led me to go away and actually seek mental health treatment. And for anyone listening, it just didn't feel right to just come back and pick up where I left off.
With the last podcast.
Yeah, I'm just not the same person from before I left and did this program. So I think it's important to kind of talk through why going mental? What's the new podcast about?
Yeah.
Why I decided to change?
To me, it seems like maybe this one is a little more personal to you and like guided by your experiences, which I think is super cool. But I'm just curious for you how it feels.
Yeah, it is much more personal. You know, I had this experience going away, which we'll talk about. You know, maybe people have an experience like extreme depression or extreme anxiety, but at least everyone I know has had some little kind of passing with it.
Yeah.
And especially with COVID and kind of reentering the world during a pandemic, you know, all of a sudden it's like the world has shut down. You're not going into your job. So many people lost their job. And I think if people hadn't really experienced anxiety or depression before this all happened, I'm sure they at least know one person who has struggled with definitely anxiety during COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you're hitting like a point where I think that this isolation that all of us have endured has made us like look back at ourselves and like look inwards and explore like what we have going on. And I think there's a larger conversation of mental health happening, maybe because people were sitting with themselves more, which I think is really interesting. So this feels like very in line with the time right now.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of dive in and talk to different people about what's your experience been with mental health, with just media in general. I wanted maybe some like political commentary. I just feel like I'm growing into myself more. Definitely my friends are. So yeah, I'm excited to see what happens with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you also have, from what I know, some really interesting guests coming on, which will be exciting and cool. And you'll get so many different perspectives across the board. So in that way, it could be similar to your last podcast, like so many different people. However, with this new kind of theme. So I'm curious, like, if you want to talk about how you got to New York. I mean, you came to New York when you were really young initially, right?
Yes, 17. I mean, like right after I graduated high school, and I'm young for my grade.
Right.
So 17. But yeah, I think that's important, especially for someone who's listening that maybe isn't super familiar with me or Killer and Sweet Thing in my story. So I grew up in Seattle, Washington. I come from a little bit of a blended family. My mom was actually from Mongolia and my dad is from Seattle. And my mom had a young daughter
when she met my dad. And my dad actually was just traveling through Europe and passing through Budapest when he met my mom at a restaurant bar. And he was only supposed to stay for like a week, but he ended up staying for 2 years after they met and went on their date.
Yeah, this story is so great. It's also knowing your dad personally, I can just see, because he is so charming. Like, I can imagine him like on this trip and meeting your mom, who was one of the most beautiful women I think I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, just like such a cute love story and so romantic. And then so my sister was probably 4 or 5, and then they ended up moving to Seattle and getting married and having my 2 brothers, and then I'm the youngest. And when I was 8 years old, my mom actually passed away really suddenly. So my mom actually passed away from a brain aneurysm. So it's like super sudden. It's almost like someone starts having a seizure, and then hers was fatal. But it was like 1 second, everything was normal. She was actually making me a sandwich, and I had had a play date with like my really good childhood friend that day. And it was just like a normal summertime day. I think it was in June. And yeah, just by that evening, I remember going to the hospital and my dad being like, "You have to say goodbye." I mean, you're so young. I was 8, that I don't think you can really comprehend that change, especially when it was so instant. And my dad struggled with like really severe kind of substance abuse and drinking after my mom passed away. And I think that was his way of coping. But with 4 kids, and especially I'm a lot younger than my siblings, I think I really was around it the most, much more than my siblings. And when, I mean, when you're a child, you're totally dependent on your parents.
Of course, yeah.
So just kind of being around that and not really understanding his behavior has definitely had like a lasting effect on me that I don't really think I had dealt with until I went away.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because when like people start to explore their upbringing or like what makes them them, it's really made me think about like the experiences I had when I was young and maybe look at my parents in a new way that you don't really look at. Like when you're a kid, it's like your whole life, like you're completely dependent on them. And then when you become an adult, you get a new perspective. And I think that can be really, really jarring, but also like healing in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I think so many people put their parents on a pedestal, especially when you're a child.
Totally.
You're like they're this perfect person or they can't make mistakes. But then you realize, oh, wow, my parents were just people who just grew up and decided to like procreate.
Literally. Yeah, exactly.
Just, like, have kids. They're not perfect. I think for a lot of years, I harbored a lot of resentment. I just felt really kind of lonely, abandoned, neglected due to some of the stuff I had to deal with really young. And since then, I've really come around of like, listen, my dad did the best he could with the cards he was dealt.
Yeah.
Like he is an amazing person. He just wasn't prepared to be a single dad overnight.
Yeah. And he was coping with the trauma of that, which is
of like the loss of his partner, which I still think he's kind of coping with. He's still not remarried and it's been like 10, 15 years.
Yeah. Also, so your dad is from an Irish Catholic family.
Yes.
And I feel like the kind of the presence of religion has been very, I feel like it's shaped who you are. You went to a Catholic high school in Seattle.
Yeah. So I went to Catholic school my whole damn life.
Wow. That's so interesting. And I think that is like very kind of telling as to where you started. And like, I feel like, I don't know if people know that you started on Tumblr. I feel like people did know that, but I don't know if they know that now.
Yeah, because I feel like Tumblr is kind of a thing of the past.
Yeah, I know. It's like what MySpace was when we like got to high school, you know? So on Tumblr, I feel like, what kind of set you apart on Tumblr, or like why people loved your Tumblr, because you were really open and honest about your experiences as a young person and sex and I think depression and anxiety. Like you talked really openly. And I remember on your Tumblr, like people could ask you personal questions and answer them. And it always struck me how honest you were. And I think that's so much part of who you are. And I'm just curious how, like, what brought you to that Tumblr space, or like what, you know, kind of brought you to the internet? I feel like that was kind of the start of your career and as it is now.
Yeah. I mean, I think the internet as I knew it back then was like kind of like this knight in shining armor for me. I felt so alone and so kind of suppressed, and I had nowhere to turn to. You know, I'm growing up with a single dad. My sister's a lot older. She's already out of the house by the time I'm born.
Oh, wow.
She was 17 when I was born. So I'm in a house full of boys. I have two brothers and a dad. My dad's really Catholic, conservative, and I just had no one to talk to about, like, even getting my period, like shaving my legs for the first time. Like, I was like in the dark. So yeah. I'm like, either I'm finding that stuff out and learning from my friends who are my same age, or I'm scouring the internet. And so the internet became my saving grace, where I could Google things, I could talk to other young people online. And so I started this Tumblr where I did just that. And I had a boyfriend in high school, and so I would talk about our relationship and losing my virginity. And now, looking back on it as an adult, I think there was something comforting about almost the lack of intimacy that I was able to do this behind a computer screen.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to kind of my story and even this podcast, that I always felt protected from having, like, I wasn't comfortable having a lot of these conversations, talking about this stuff in person.
Of course. Yeah.
Like, I'm not a super intimate person in that way. I don't enjoy being vulnerable. It's actually really hard for me, but I would be like alone in my teenage bedroom talking to people online, and it made me feel protected.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting being close with you, and I feel like I know you so well. But now that I'm thinking about it, I feel like we do have very intimate conversations, but I think most intimate conversations on both our end are like through the phone.
I think that was a big thing I worked on in my program, was how can I be more vulnerable and more intimate in my relationships so that I can have deeper, more meaningful friendships, relationships with my family, that I can hopefully one day be married in, like, a long-lasting partnership. And these are things, like, I work and talk about with my therapist.
Yeah. And do you think that losing your mom at such a young age has shaped, you know, the way that you enter into intimate relationships with both friends and partners?
Yeah, I think I stay really protected. I think I definitely have fears of, oh, people always leave. Nothing lasts forever. So yeah, I'm a very guarded person in my intimate relationships. And I also think I came from this quintessential Catholic family. I mean, my dad grew up in he was born in the 1950s. Like, oh, we don't really talk about emotions.
Of course.
And I think my mom was actually really different, and she was a Pisces, but I think she was super into being like intimate and talking about emotions. And so my parents balanced each other out. But I grew up for the majority of my life with a dad who lives his life that way.
Right.
So it's not like I was really exposed to like intimacy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for many people, it's like, we think we know how to create intimate relationships. And then as you get older, you're like, oh shit, like this is, you know, much more difficult. And I have like way more walls up than maybe I expected.
And I also think the creation of the internet and just like texting, social media has made it tenfold harder for intimate relationships, just because you could be like reading into, oh my God, why didn't he text me back? But he's on Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I don't want to seem like too attached or too clingy, so I'm going to play games. Like, I think a lot of that stuff feels like kind of a new generational phenomenon.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's interesting. I think that who you are online is 100% a version of you, and you are open and honest. But at the same time, there's a completely other version of you that I don't see online. And like knowing you privately, I'm like, whoa, like people don't get to see that side of you.
Well, I think that's kind of when I went into treatment, I felt like I had such a split identity. Also from getting online at so young, like I've been online pretty much nonstop since I was 16.
But that I think about that and I'm like that, like, I mean, as a 26-year-old, it's like, you know, being online gets in my head. It makes me feel like, you know, I'm constantly comparing. It's like, you've kind of always had a big personality online. And I can only imagine that, like, that can be really difficult at times.
Oh, for sure. And it's definitely, like, gone in phases.
Yeah.
And I think that was something that really came to a breaking point before I went away. I felt like I was struggling with imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, I started on Tumblr and then I moved to New York, went to college and decided, oh, I can do this for real. I can make a career out of this. Let me start my website. I had met like a coder that went to NYU really casually and he built me a website and I just like wrote everything myself, like how to insert a tampon and what it was like getting my IUD put in.
Right.
From these first person accounts. And then I was like, oh, I'm sharing such a slim perspective. Like, I want anyone who comes to the website to be able to find a piece that resonates with them. So I started asking my friends, would you write a piece? And it kind of just grew from there. And I feel like things with work just kind of took off way more than I expected. And I went and spoke at Columbia and got asked to speak at Brown University and like do all of these amazing things that I felt like at the end of the day when I was just in bed alone, like, I'm not qualified for this. Why are they asking me to do this? What if I sound dumb? Like, I just fell down the rabbit hole of self-doubt and navigating like, oh, man, I'm trying to run a business. I'm 21 or, you know, like 22 years old. I'm so young and I'm trying to delegate like several people who work with me. We have an office. I'm really thankful for how this is unfolding. And I can't believe we're reaching so many people. But at the same time, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that became, that took a huge toll on me mentally.
Yeah, of course.
Like I just felt like I was spread so thin. And I remember like having moments, and I think I even talked to you about this, maybe, but just wishing like, oh, I just wish in these moments I could talk to my mom or have the support of a motherly figure.
Yeah, of course.
Of like the warmth and someone to kind of root me on and tell me like you are where you're meant to be.
I want to get into like what happened before you decided to go into treatment, why you decided to go into treatment. I felt like you had created this persona online, this, you know, you had this career and then you felt like you couldn't keep up with the persona that was online.
Yeah. Or like the trajectory.
Yeah.
Like I was running on the hamster wheel and the hamster wheel started going a little too fast for me. And I'm like, oh man, I'm going to fall on my face.
Yeah. You went to McLean. What was it? I feel like it was kind of at the height of the Killer and the Sweet thing. Like you had this big blog, you were kind of running this office, you're doing the podcast. But also, what was happening like in your personal life at that time?
Oh, man, I was like a non-functioning human, which almost I was so high, appeared to be high functioning. Like I was able to make it to every podcast. I could sit and help with the edits. I could do the things I needed to get done. You know, I could go and speak at Brown and do these things, but I wouldn't sleep the night before. I was so anxious. I wasn't eating. I would have panic attacks. I was crying all the time. And I had everything I wanted career-wise, but I honestly was so suicidal. And I think that was really the point where I was like, holy shit, no career is worth this when I don't even want to be around tomorrow to kind of enjoy this.
What was, I mean, depression is very, and suicidal feelings are very complicated, complex, but do you remember if there was like a specific reason or something that was happening that made you feel that way? Or is just like you were so overwhelmed by what was going on?
I think there are several things in play. So I had been in a really long-term relationship, mm-hmm. kind of when this stuff started. And when my romantic relationship started going south and becoming quite toxic, we would break up and get back together, break up and get back together. And that exasperated issues that I had already had. So listen, I come into a relationship with a lot of baggage. I feel like I'm pretty transparent about that with my romantic partners. I'm really aware of what I bring to the table and I'm no saint.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the person that I was dating at that time definitely did things that exasperated, you know, things that I had in a way that no one else I'd ever dated had exasperated them, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I don't think, and I'm not on here to even name this person, to bash this person, to say it's all their fault, because it's not. We were just a horrible match. Mm-hmm. And when we kind of got into the back and forth on and off thing, it was like literally the death of me.
Yeah.
So much comparison. You know, when we were off, he would clearly be talking to other girls or hooking up with them. This was kind of at the time when Instagram had that feature where you could see what people were liking. And I just could not look away. And it got to the point where I was causing myself so much emotional distress. And the comparison was literally killing me.
Yeah.
And I feel like embarrassed even talking about this. Like, it's so painful to even talk about. But I'm sure there's people that relate, you know, looking at girls he was talking to. Oh my God, are they – why doesn't he want to be with me? They're prettier than me. They're thinner than me. And yeah, I just fell down a spiral and I couldn't – I got really sick. Like, that's how I would explain it. It just became mm-hmm. really obsessive. Mm-hmm. I have like some obsessive compulsive tendencies that I've kind of more newly found out about. But that on top of work was really what sent my life to like probably the worst place it's ever been.
I remember – that time, and I remember the way that you would talk about it is as if you felt like there was so much finality to it, like this, like everything was going to end and there was like everything was final. It was like very a fatalistic way of looking at everything. And I don't think it's because you're like a cynic and you're like, this is fatal, and like, but I think it's very real for you. It felt like in a lot of ways like, you know, death. And I think that has to do with maybe losing your mom. And but it was like the way that you experienced these things was like so fatal. And I remember it, as your friend, it was so painful for me because I could see how much pain you were in. Mm-hmm. And like,
I mean, I was like literally not functioning. Like, I think there were months where like I didn't sleep more than like 4 hours.
Yeah.
Or I just couldn't eat. I was in so much pain. I was like, literally just put me out of my misery. Like, I want to kill myself. Like, pretty much like every single day.
Yeah. So you're going through that with your partner at the time. And then you also met someone after that, right?
Yeah.
And I felt like understood you in a way that other people maybe hadn't. And he was the one who kind of guided you maybe into thinking about treatment. Is that right?
Yeah. So like I said, I was in a really on and off, super toxic, like honestly, like emotionally abusive relationship. And at one of the points when we were off in a breakup, I had met someone else that I began dating. And I would say like looking back on it, it was more of a friendship. And we even talk about this to this day. He's one of my best friends, but he had struggled with some mental health problems, and he basically like sat me down one day and was like, you are sick, and I tell you this because I really care about you, but I don't even think you're aware what's going on. Mm-hmm. And there are options out there to get you help. like, if you want to not feel this bad, I will help you kind of explore how to not.
Wow, that's huge.
And no one had really said that to me before.
Mm-hmm.
So he ended up breaking up with me. He was like, you're too sick to be in a relationship. I care about you. I'm not leaving you. But this is hurting you being in this relationship.
Mm.
And to this day, I'm like, wow, that is one of the most kind of selfless things anyone has ever done for me.
Mm.
So he helped me find this program in New York at Columbia, and it was a group therapy program, psychiatric program, by the way. It's not at the university.
Right.
And I started going 5 days a week, and I would do group therapy. And honestly, I swear it made me worse.
Really?
Not that the program wasn't great, but to go and work on yourself that intensely all day and then be able to go home to my apartment, I lived alone, and be able to look on my phone and see the world out there and be alone with my thoughts. And yeah, I almost felt like, holy shit, I'm going even more crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I need someone to take my phone away from me.
I remember you said that to me so many times. You're like, someone needs to lock this phone away from me. Like, I can't. And I remember that was a huge thing for you in going and choosing to
go. Yeah, I had no self-control. I literally didn't have the self-control or the tools to not be driving myself actually crazy. So I was in that program for like probably a month, and I told them, I was like, listen, I need a higher level of care. And actually, a few people kind of fought me on that, including my dad and my therapist at the time.
Really?
They said, we just don't think you need that level of care. We don't think you're that – not that you're not struggling and sick, but we don't think you're that sick. I think it'll be overwhelming. I don't think you're ready to kind of go away to a hospital setting. Like, you don't know what you're signing yourself up for. And I really had to advocate for myself. Like, I know – this is what I need.
Mm.
Let me just try it for a month.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that speaks to kind of my personality.
Yeah.
Like, if I want it, I'm going to get it. But yeah. Also, really, I did like most of the paperwork by myself. Like, a lot of the people who are in my program, you know, they're so sick that their relatives are making sure everything's taken care of. Like, I literally had to go get interviews I had with different psychologists before you can even get into this program. Like,
right.
You have to fill out 50 pages of paperwork. Like, I did all of that on my own while I thought I was dying.
Yeah.
To even be able to go to this program.
I think something I remember as well that stood out to me was like when you had written to me from while you were in the program, and we talked about it afterwards as well. But like, so many of the people who were there, like, they were at the point in their life where, like, what you just said, like, they were given an ultimatum by their family, or their family forced them to go. Like, they had absolutely no other choice, and they were not there by choice.
Yeah.
And I feel like you, and I remember before this when you were talking about going, and I remember telling you that I thought that it was a good idea, and, you know, you were scared, of course. It's a huge thing. And, but I remember, like, always thinking, like, you are choosing to do this, and, like, that, I think, is a testament to like your commitment to feeling better. And that's huge. Like, that to me is like so brave and so courageous. And I just remember, you know, a lot of people don't choose to go into these programs. And like, you knew that like you didn't want to be living this way, and you did it all on your own, which is amazing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, definitely on my own in some ways. But like I said, a huge part of that was to the person that I had dated, who kind of showed me and introduced me actually to McLean, and really showed me that like you can feel better. There are people and professionals who can figure out what's going on and help you feel better.
Yeah, absolutely. So McLean is in Boston at Harvard.
So McLean is like one of the oldest, definitely like the most famous psychiatric hospital in the United States. It's like where Girl Interrupted, where that book takes place, where the movie takes place.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. That's funny. And it's in Belmont, Massachusetts. It's like a massive huge old hospital on a campus. I was actually in a residential program. I wasn't in an inpatient unit. So that's kind of like high risk emergency. If you're suicidal or you attempt suicide, then you would be in the inpatient unit. If you're having psychosis, mm-hmm. if you are schizophrenic and they haven't found the right meds for you, then maybe you would be in the inpatient unit. I went to a residential one mm-hmm. that actually was off campus. So it was in a normal residential neighborhood. You would never know that it was a part of the hospital just walking by. Mm-hmm. It was an all women's program. There were probably like six of us at a time, but they rotate in and out. So when I was new there, as people graduated, then we would get new patients.
I see.
And I mean, it was so scary. Like,
I mean, you just show up.
I just showed up with a suitcase.
Did you? Yeah.
I went straight to a class.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So in the morning, you wake up, you can like eat breakfast if you want to. It's really on your own time. You go to class.
How's the food?
Honestly, the dinner was horrible. If anyone's listening in that program, you should really up it, please. But you'd be in class all day. So back-to-back classes, I don't know, just learning about what anxiety is, what it does to your blood pressure, tools to deal with having a panic attack. I mean, it was like behavioral therapy. So like if you just jump out of bed, practice getting out of bed when you're super depressed, slowly it starts to like kind of work on your brain chemistry. And that's what's cool about McLean is it is connected to Harvard University. So they do research, like people who are getting their degrees, PhDs, are doing research for McLean. They just have a lot of like new stuff that they're trying out and, you know, backed by real data. So I just felt like I was in really good hands. But I walked in, I got there, and I said, take my phone. So I just handed them my phone. And they were like, wow, that was really easy.
Is that mandatory?
Yeah, they do take everyone's phone kind of in the beginning. And then some people, depending on your treatment and what you're struggling with, some people had their phones. And right. I didn't have my phone for over 5 months.
Were you nervous about that?
No, I was so relieved.
Really?
Because I was able to keep in touch with my friends. I wrote letters. I almost feel like I developed more intimate relationships with my friends while I was there. Like I have these letters that I'll have for the rest of my life that are so dear mm-hmm. to me. But I didn't miss having a phone. Like I didn't check Instagram for 5 months. It was amazing for my health. But we had TVs, like we would do movie nights. I could watch TV anytime during my break hours or in the evening. And you go to the store twice a week. So basically you're in class all day. And then in the afternoon, you see your therapist. So you have a therapist appointment twice a week with your main therapist. We have a appointment with a psychiatrist once a week. And then you have an appointment with a family therapist, which is mandatory in the program, once a week. So my dad, I did therapy with my dad for the first time.
Wow.
And then you also meet with a Harvard researcher once a week. And so they tailor that really specific to each person. So for example, for me, I did exposure therapy. And that was honestly one of my favorite parts. I mean, it was horrible. It was the hardest part of the program, probably one of them. But it was really interesting. Just, I feel like I got a degree in like psychology or at least a degree in myself.
Mm.
Like I know exactly coming out of that program what my problems are, where they stem from, which problems are like nature versus nurture. You know, what problems are actually just brain chemistry that were actually probably passed down from from my parents, grandparents. Like you really get to know yourself, and I feel very privileged to have gone away to this program, and I'm just happy that I made the most of it, because there are definitely people that go to those programs that don't want to be there, and that's really sad to me, because just to waste that opportunity to better yourself.
Mm. Yeah, I get a lot of people don't get that opportunity. So do you want to talk a little bit about, like, I mean, you were with all women. How many people were there?
There's probably like 6 to 8 women at a time.
Okay. Well, that's an intimate group.
We all have our own bedrooms and we all eat dinner together. We have to. And we all eat lunch together. Yep.
That probably, so there's definitely some interesting dynamics, huh?
Oh, and some really interesting characters for sure. Because the age is really across the board. So there are women who are in their 40s. There were moms in there. There were women who were in their early 20s. People come from all over the world to this program. I met a lot of people I probably wouldn't have otherwise met.
Mm-hmm.
But I also got to know these women and they got to know me almost on a level that I don't know if I'll ever get to know other people that well. Things I would tell my therapist, you kind of bring up in the group. So these are like your deepest, darkest insecurities and secrets that you're sharing with like a group of other women.
Yeah.
Like things that normally I would never even say out loud.
I don't know if you want to share like what your diagnosis was when you went there. You can if you want. You don't have to if you don't want to. Or you can answer like the women who were in this program. Did everyone kind of have the same diagnosis, or was it all different things?
A few different things, but mostly the same. Like there are different programs at McLean. So let's say you have obsessive compulsive disorder. There's an OCD program. There's a program for personality disorders. So you are in a group of people who really share your same issues, which is what was really different and why I struggled in the Columbia program, because that one you're with people who struggle with all different types of things. So I felt like I would leave that group and be like, no one said anything I personally relate to today. And I feel like the craziest person in this room. Whereas when I went to the McLean program, I was like, ah, here are my people. Like they get it. They understand. Yeah. I went in there with like really high levels of shame. Like, I'm so crazy. I don't understand myself, but I also feel so deeply understood by other people. And then I just met these other women and I was like, yeah, they can be nuts. And sometimes they get on my nerves, but each and every one of them is like a special, unique person. And so I think the program kind of taught me to begin the journey of like loving myself, as corny as that sounds.
Yeah. And to not, I think as well, like what I can hear you say is like not judge other people, because you don't know what someone is struggling with. And
exactly.
Like, you know, it is complex and confusing, and you know, that doesn't define who they are.
Yeah. I was just so hard on myself.
Yeah.
And I definitely think when you're really unhappy with yourself, you can be judgmental towards others. So I think overall, just coming out of that, I feel like a better person. I feel more empathetic towards myself. And so I definitely think that's kind of why I wanted to do this podcast and just have it be like a more raw version of like having the conversations that people don't want to have, but it's things like we all experience.
Yeah. Well, do you feel like, I mean, there's so much shame around mental health, which you just said. Do you feel like you still struggle with that shame? Like, I feel like people can be like, oh, like, yeah, I went to treat, you know, people maybe think, I don't know, like, oh, I went to treatment and like, I don't need to be shameful anymore. But I think that you can come out of treatment and still feel really shameful. And like,
oh, yeah, for sure. A lot of shame. I think a lot of shame also came from just my background. Like, my family is like not super pro medication, and I'm on Lexapro, which helps me tremendously, and I want to stay on it. But that was kind of a big thing of like, okay, well, when are you going to get off your meds? Like, when you don't need them anymore. And so I think when you hear that and that's reflected back to you for so many years, you just start to internalize it. Like, something's wrong with me. Yeah, I'm crazy. And I think I'll struggle with that shame probably for the rest of my life, but I do feel like it's dissipating. And really my friend who kind of helped me go away, he was really the first person to tell me, like, you just have to treat it like a physical illness. Like, you mm-hmm. wouldn't think twice about going to the doctor if, like, you broke your foot or if you were having heart palpitations. So it's your brain. Like, people forget that, but it's literally my brain is firing things off that when I'm under a lot of stress, maybe I act in certain ways or I get anxiety, I can't function.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even if other people can't understand that, just knowing that for myself has, I feel like I've come out of that program so much more calm and accepting, like, this is my situation.
Yeah. Earlier you said that Girl Interrupted is based on McLean. Is that right?
The woman who wrote it went to McLean. And
oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, like, I feel like that kind of that book and that movie are what people think of when they're like, oh, you know, they're sending these girls to treatment. Like, that's, and it's such a, like, there's very extreme things that happen in it. Do you feel like that is kind of a myth of what goes on in treatment centers, or you think that, like, oh no, I had experiences like that? Or do you think it, you know?
I didn't have experiences like that, but I think that movie takes place more in the inpatient. Also, the book was written in, like, the 1960s, like, maybe, like, early 70s. So it was just, like, a really different time, and they just didn't have the research that they do now. And then the movie's based off of that. So, yeah, my residential program was, like, pretty chill. Like, we could sit around and watch TV and, like, bake cookies and eat popcorn. And, I mean, definitely had our moments that I feel like I can't talk about because of HIPAA. And maybe I'll talk about in the future. But, oh, my God, I witnessed wild things. But everyone – you have to be of a level of function to be in this program because it's so rigorous. So, like, someone who's having hallucinations or is violent towards other people, they wouldn't be able to attend this program, you know? So maybe they're up at the hospital in inpatient to kind of get the hallucinations under control on a medication regime that works for them. Then if they needed to enter this program, they could.
Yeah.
Like, you can't have an eating disorder in this program.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You have to get that treated and work on that before you can even come to this program. Like, they will make you leave if they discover you have one.
Wow. That's really interesting.
But, like, you're never alone. I mean, I guess I'm alone when I sleep. But for the most part, like, there are counselors constantly in the room with you. Chaperones when you go to the store. And I mean, you're with women who are really suicidal, and you have people that self-harm. And
what were the chaperones like?
They're young college students who are trying to get into usually to med school or grad programs.
Oh, cool.
So they do this program because it looks great on their resume, but they're just, like, normal college students. It was, like, a little odd.
Did you feel like you, like, could be friend, like, you would, like, chat with them like a friend, or did it feel very much like, okay, you're, like, here to babysit me, so I can't, like, shoot
basically.
The shit with you? Okay.
Yeah, and there's so many rules in the program, which is kind of annoying for someone who's, like, been living on their own and, like, running a business. Like, I felt babied for sure at times. Like, you have to rent out your razor if you want to shave your legs. Like, there's just, like, so many – like, you can't have certain shampoo in the bathroom or your room if it contains alcohol in it.
Whoa. What, for what reason?
So people don't drink it. I think a big misconception, and people sometimes think, like, I went away for alcohol or drug usage, and I didn't. That's not why I went away. Like, I had to be sober in this program. They're not going to let you, like, have a cocktail at dinner, but that wasn't the reason I went away.
Is there anything that you, like, you know, I think maybe people who are also struggling, who are thinking about going into treatment, and you were there for 5 months, is that right? A long time. Who are scared to go away, or scared to, you know, spend 5 months of their life kind of separate from their friends and their family and, like, the world that they know or that's familiar. Do you have anything that you would want to tell them? Like,
yeah, I think that think of someone you love so, so much, like, whether it's a a partner, a family member, and, you know, would you think twice about having them go away if it meant like a new lease on their life?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think people hold so much self-hatred that they can't think about themselves in that way. But you need to just kind of take yourself out of it. And like, you deserve, you have one life here on earth. Like, you deserve to be healthy and happy.
Yeah. And what was it like coming out in the middle of the pandemic?
Oh, God. I mean, I knew, I another misconception, like, I knew COVID was happening. It's not like I didn't have a phone and, like, no one told me.
Right. And like, you came out and you're like, oh, I'm in the apocalypse.
Yeah. No, like, things really changed there. But we had TVs. We had news. I could – you go to the store twice a week. On the weekends, like, we would go do activities. And you could go to Whole Foods or Target. Like, we had some – normalcy. So I knew when things were breaking, but that was honestly a big reason that I left. So I actually left probably like 2-3 weeks before I was going to discharge, because COVID, this is like, I feel like last May when things were really bad. And I was like, I just want to be with my family. And also the fun things that kept me going in the program, such as going to the store twice a week or going to Target or doing the outings, all yeah. those things got canceled. So like, we just stayed in the house 24/7.
Right. So it felt even, you were like, I was already isolated and now I'm even more isolated.
Yeah. And I was like, the one thing I have to look forward to this week that keeps me going on like my hardest days, I can't do anymore. Like, fuck this shit. So I was like, I need to leave. I'm just going to leave. I've been here for 5 months. I can't believe I even lasted 5 months. This was like, as much as I talk about it, like, it was great. It was rainbows and roses. Like, I'm so glad I did it. It was the hardest fucking experience of my life. And it probably will be the hardest thing I ever did.
Yeah.
And like, there were days where I cried all day. I didn't sleep because I was crying all night. Days I felt suicidal. I felt alone. I didn't have a phone. Like, I really just had to sit there with my thoughts and figure out why I felt this way. And yeah, so when I didn't have the little luxuries, I was like, I can't do this anymore. So I re-entered the world into COVID. I went to Seattle. And
so you left 3 weeks early.
I left like 3 weeks early.
What is the program okay with that? Like, how does discharging work?
So normally before COVID like really fucked up a lot of things. So normally you would actually go straight into an outpatient program. And so you spend another 6 months. So it's really like a year long program.
Wow.
And during the outpatient, you would get a job. And so you kind of use the tools and you have your doctors and support system while working and seeing with like those stressors, if you can maintain your progress. So obviously no one's getting a job during COVID. Also, I'm technically part of like a hospital, so they're really strict about who you're exposed to and germs. So, which is why we couldn't leave campus anymore, the house. And yeah, so I went to Seattle, but they were really great. They allowed me to keep working with my family therapist and my normal therapist because of COVID. And I actually still work with my therapist from McLean, and I see her twice a week.
Oh, wow. So you've continued that relationship.
Yeah.
And do you feel like twice a week is, does it feel like it's a lot or too little or just the right amount?
No, it's like perfect. I just feel like so much changes in the span of even a week that it's nice to be able to like really work on the present with her. I spent 5 months working on my past and what my issues are. And so we have such a unique, strong relationship. Like, she knows me so well. She can like call me on my bullshit.
Yeah.
Which I love. Like, I adore my therapist.
That's amazing. That's so important. I feel like you have to create that like relationship or else it becomes something that you resent doing, which is like not helpful.
Yeah. And like, I have some friends who see a therapist and they're like, don't tell them certain things. Mm. Like, I tell my therapist everything. I'm like, yeah, if I slept with someone, like I slept with this person, or I did some drugs when I went out the other night. Like, I literally tell her everything because I'm like, why would I be wasting not only my time, but their time? And therapy's expensive, like money, by not kind of being super transparent so you can help me the most.
Yeah.
If I'm hiding things from you, then
you're only doing a disservice to yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, now it's been, oh my gosh, a year, huh?
You know, it's so crazy, Maya.
Time is we're getting old. How do you, I'm just curious, like, how do you feel about talking about this stuff? You know, this is going to be, are you feeling good? Does it feel nerve wracking? Do you feel like you've like, you know, does it feel cathartic?
It does feel cathartic. It just feels so comfortable talking to you about it too, to be honest.
Oh, I'm glad.
Like, seriously, like, I feel like I've reached a place. I'm also feel so stable and like I'm doing so well where it's not like I'm in the middle of the tornado and trying to talk about it. Like, I think that would be really overwhelming.
Of course. Yeah.
But I've reached a place where like, I'm not there yet. Like, this is going to be a journey for the rest of my life. And like, that's something I really learned and had to prepare myself. Like, I have really severe mental health issues that are probably going to follow me for the rest of my life. But I now have the tools and understanding to know what to do when things start to get out of control.
Yeah.
And to just take it day by day. And I'm really excited to like have these conversations with people on this podcast.
Yeah. Oh, well, I am, as someone who loves you and who I'm so proud of you. Like, I really am, because I hear you say that. And I remember, you know, there's a point where like, you felt like there was no solution. And like, there, like, you were like, is this going to be the rest of my life? Like, that felt like an impossible task. And now to hear you say, like, I know it's going to be like part of my life, but I can do it. Like, is, I just think that I'm very proud of you and I love you. And I think that that's like a huge deal.
I love you too.